Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, professors, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight, featuring commentary by Patty Blagojevich and Leonard Goodman. Our program tonight coming to you from our own base at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago, where our toll-free lines are open at 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289. If you'd like to email me a comment, it's Bruce Dumont at museum.tv. You want to tweet me a comment, it's at Dumo, at D-U-M-O. And, of course, you can join us on the World Wide Web, audio and video, at beyondthebeltway.com. Well, this past week in this country, it was another bombshell week for President Trump and his legal problems dealing with special prosecutors and Robert Mueller and his attorney and all things related legal. It was really a big week, including the James Comey revelations and the release of his memo and his book. So there's a lot out there about lawyers and clients and charges and countercharges and the legal system and everything else. And in the middle of this, there was also a decision last week by the United States Supreme Court that they chose not to review the case of former Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich, who's serving 14 years in prison in Colorado for corruption charges. And so tonight, in this first hour, it's unique. We haven't done this for quite a while on this program. We are joined, and we have a special guest, and she is Patty Blagojevich. She is the former First Lady of the state of Illinois, married to Governor Rod Blagojevich. And, Patty, nice to have you with us.
Thank you.
And I should mention at the beginning of the broadcast, Patty and I have known each other for well over 30 years, and I've known Rod for a little less than that. So there's a personal element. I wanted to be totally candid with that with our audience. But tonight, because the Supreme Court rejected your husband's case, and it was the second time they've chosen not to become involved, your only hope now is that President Trump will step forward and either commute Rod's sentence or give him a full pardon. Is that correct, or is there some other thing that could happen?
Well, I mean, there are other things that could potentially happen. At some point, the Supreme Court's going to have to take up a case like my husband's, because they're going to have to clarify this split in the circuits, and they're going to have to clarify this very fuzzy law that exists. And when they do finally take that case up and they rule the way we believe they'll rule, I think we'd be able to go back to court. But who knows when that's going to be. In the near term, trying to appeal to the president pretty much is our only shot. You know, we thought the courts were going to be able to work the way they're supposed to. We had faith in our court system and our judicial system. We thought, like, a judge's job was to make sure that you had a fair trial. But we were totally underestimated the power of the prosecutor to, bully and influence the system.
And as we unfold, by the way, your attorney joins us, and we're going to hear from him in the next segment. But because Donald Trump is so important to your family's future, when Rod was a guest on The Apprentice,
right. What
did he ever share with you about the personal conversations that he had with Donald Trump, and how close did they become during that period, if at all?
Well, I think that they had a good rapport. I think that president, then, real estate mogul, had always nice things to say to Rod, thought he was really getting a raw deal. Obviously had a decent opinion of him to have him on the show. And then one thing that really stuck in my mind was when my daughters and I flew out to New York for the finale of The Apprentice, because they gather everybody up. And Rod and I and the two girls found ourselves in an elevator with the president and Ivanka, his daughter. And the president said to my girls, they said, you girls should be proud of your father. He's a good man. And he was very kind to my girls.
Did he reach out to you after the conviction?
No, he never has. But I have seen some of his public statements. People have asked him around. People have asked him on the campaign trail or that kind of thing, or when the judge reinstated the 14-year sentence even after five of the counts were thrown out. And he had good public comments that are on the record. So I feel like he knows Rod. I think he likes him. And, you know, I think I don't think there's anybody that could really say that a 14-year sentence is appropriate.
How do you go about getting on his radar? I mean, because of your background, because of Rod's background, I mean, there's political people that you know, maybe most of them on the Democratic side of the aisle, but I'm sure you know Republicans as well. How do you get before the president?
Well, I think that's the, you know, that's the big question. There's so much going on in the world. Obviously, the president has so much on his plate. I mean, world events are crazy, and, you know, domestic events are crazy. He's got a lot to think about. So there's, you know, to be able to kind of cut through that is difficult. And, you know, we are going through the legal paths where, you know, we've got, we'll be filing commutation petitions before the pardon attorney. So there are legal steps we can take.
If you were to look into the camera right now and talk to the president, what would you say to him?
Well, I can't, you know, I don't, the president has to look at this and, you know, look at the merits of it. And I believe that if he just took a look at the facts and saw the facts of the case, he could see that justice was not served and that the power to pardon or commute someone's sentence exists because it's a chance to fix things that the court did not get right. And so with that power, I'm hoping that he will look at our case and see that justice was not served. We relied on the courts and they let us down, and that he would bring some relief and help to my family and bring my husband home.
Because he is currently involved in some questionable acts, at least in his view, of federal prosecutors and special prosecutors, and Mr. Comey and also Mr. Mueller, is he in a unique situation now where he may understand some of the aggressive action by federal prosecutors?
You know, it's really interesting because I was talking to a friend of mine and she reminded me that James Mueller was the FBI director when my husband was arrested and this whole thing started. I mean, the same cast of characters that are swirling around now, the president, were there 10 years ago coming after my husband, and probably with a lot of the same tactics that, you know, using the FBI for political purposes. You know, they came after my husband, and they're still doing it. These people, they're using their office to go after anybody that they don't like who might be unpopular or controversial.
Now, there are perhaps hundreds, if not thousands, of people listening to this broadcast this evening. They may know someone that's in prison, maybe a loved one, maybe a friend, and they know the impact that it has on a family. And they may be listening tonight, maybe somewhat sympathetic, but might also say to you, but Patty, this happens to lots and lots of people. What makes you special?
Well, you know, my heart goes out to any family member of someone who's incarcerated. I mean, it's having lived through it for the last 6 years, I know the toll it takes on family members, and especially the children, and the time that you're separated, you'll never be able to get back. So my heart goes out to them, and I think anybody that is wrongly imprisoned should, you know, be able to pursue the opportunity to be able to, you know, correct the injustice.
We're talking to Patty Blagojevich, the former First Lady of Illinois. We will continue and hear more about the specific legal aspects of the case when we roll on from Chicago. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. We're talking about the cases of Rod Blagojevich, the former governor of Illinois. And we're talking about this in context because some of the allegations in the Blagojevich case are similar to some of the things that are going on in the Justice Department now, with President Trump thinking that the Justice Department is overreached. And we are now joined by Leonard Goodman. He is an attorney for Rod Blagojevich. And there's a couple of legal questions that I want to ask you, Rod, and share with the audience. The terms pardon and commutation have been out there. Which are you seeking, and what? How are you most likely to be successful in releasing the governor early?
Well, you know, I think we will seek both a pardon and or a commutation. A pardon is actually erasing the conviction, mm-hmm. which is obviously the best thing you could hope for.
And that's what happened last week with Scooter Libby.
Correct.
Right, because he had been commuted earlier by President Bush and now was pardoned.
A commutation would get him home to his family, which is also important.
Right.
So we would I think a pardon would be appropriate in this case. I wouldn't recommend that in every case, but I do think it is appropriate. I think if the president looks at the facts of this case, he will see an overreach. This is not, you know, most political corruption cases that you look at are people that have enriched themselves in office. They've become rich, taken money, taken bribes, taken kickbacks. And as most people know, Blagojevich never did that. I mean, he never tried to enrich himself. He was never put money in his pocket. This wasn't about that. This was about political deals that he tried to make.
As an attorney, before you became involved with the case, you obviously were living in Illinois. It was front page in every newspaper in the state for, you know, well over a couple of years. Rod did not go quietly. He denied that he did what he had been charged with, still denies that. But he went way beyond what a normal person would do. He decided to go public, attack the Justice Department, go on television, sometimes with Patty, and he made himself a national media celebrity while the justice wheels were turning. Was that a mistake?
You know, if I was his attorney, I wouldn't have allowed him to make some of the caustic statements he made about the justice system. I think, you know, you have to understand the federal system. I mean, people are used to incredible respect, and I think that could be a mistake. I know some of the things he did is because he didn't have any money. You know, he went on some programs that maybe he didn't do it for his ego. I think some of it, they needed the money. And I think that's an interesting thing about this case is this is somebody that did not go to Springfield or to Washington to enrich themselves or their family. He actually believed in what he was doing.
Patty, do you regret that Rod went so public and so aggressive against the government during the pretrial period?
You know, it's interesting that people ask me about that, and you have to really know my husband. You know, kind of put yourself in his position. You're in this very public place. You're the, you know, governor of the fifth largest state, and somebody gets on TV and says you've committed these horrendous crimes and that Lincoln should roll over in his grave. And it hurt Rod so much that anybody would actually believe that was true, that he felt like he had to take every opportunity he could to try to tell people it wasn't true, because you know how people are. They hear these charges and they assume people are guilty without even a trial. I mean, you know, our system is guilty, innocent until proven guilty, but you know, the way people think, they think, oh, if there's smoke, there's fire, they're charging them, it's got to be true. And he just bristled at that thought that people could actually believe this of him.
But were people telling him, including yourself, were you telling him, hey, calm down, the G is out to get you, they're going to get you, don't rile them up any more than they're riled up?
Well, I don't know. I don't think, you know, had he just like sat at home and waited for his trial date, I don't think the outcome would have been any different, to be honest with you. I think that, you know, once the Patrick Fitzgerald moved on him and arrested him, and from that point on, I don't think there was any, looking back on it, there was no chance whatsoever that we would ever win, because after they brought down a sitting governor like that, they had no choice but to win. They tried him twice. They changed the jury instructions from one trial to the other. They wouldn't let our evidence in. They were going to get him no matter what, and I don't think him going on any kind of TV show would have made any difference.
Leonard, what's your assessment as to why the government came down so hard? And again, for those listening around the country, he was sentenced to 14 years in prison. Put that in context, if you will, with other governors, whether it's the former governor of Illinois, George Ryan, or whether it's the former governor of the Commonwealth of Virginia, Bob McDonald. These were executives who went to prison for a lot less time. So what's the difference here, Leonard?
You know, it's an incredibly long sentence. You know, I can't answer. I can't answer what was in the prosecutor's minds in seeking such a harsh sentence. You know, in all of those other cases, you have somebody that actually enriched themselves in office. They took vacations. They took gifts from supporters. You know, Blagojevich never did that. His case was a purely political case. You know, I think one thing people have to understand about the federal government is they pick and choose their targets. So he was selected. It's not like the state system where the police make an arrest, someone commits a crime, there's an arrest, and then it's handed over to a prosecutor. They chose him. In fact, he was chosen quite early in his administration as somebody that the feds wanted to prosecute. A lot was invested in his case, as Patty said, two trials.
Why do you think that was the case?
I don't know. I mean, I believe a lot of it is career advancement. I mean, the prosecutors that selected him and made a case against him, including Pat Fitzgerald, and then the lead prosecutors on the case, they all went on to bigger and better things. They're all partners in law firms. You know, it is a stepping stone out of that office to go after a high-profile figure.
Do you agree that Rod was singled out early in his gubernatorial career, Patty?
Yeah, you know, it's really interesting. Somebody told me that during that time that Rod got arrested, there were five other Democratic governors that were also in trouble at the same time, like the governor of Puerto Rico. There were a whole bunch of them. It was almost like the Justice Department had decided that we're going after Democratic governors. And I feel like it was a concerted effort. Like I said, some of those same players that were there then are still around using their office for political reasons. I mean, who's to know why it happened? You know, now it's just our job to have to pick up the pieces.
Has anyone, I mean, 14 years, is there any other political figure that was given that level of...
How about this? I think my husband is quite possibly the only politician in the history of the United States to be serving any time for fundraising requests. That's all he did was request fundraising, request campaign contributions. There's nobody else serving any time for campaign contributions, ever.
And that's a clarification.
Ever.
And in the case of George Ryan and Bob McDonnell of Virginia, Ryan served 5 years in prison. And in that particular case, again, there was questions as to whether or not he helped himself financially. And again, obviously, the prosecutors made a case that there was a link to that people died because of some corruption that existed in his office. But that was 5 years versus 14 years. And I guess the question that probably a lot of people are asking around the country, and I think it's the single question, there's a lot of people in the state of Illinois who are not fans of Rod Blagojevich. And I've spoken to many of them, and I'll probably hear from them tonight. But to a person, they can't imagine. They think that 14 years was too much. So I guess my question is, another aspect in a trial, you can choose to, it's the trial penalty. Explain what that means, Leonard.
You know, yes, that is a sort of a rule of thumb, is that if you go to trial, you're going to get more time. If you fight hard and, you know, try to embarrass the government, they may come down harder on you. You know, George Ryan went to trial as well, as did Governor McDonald in Virginia. Governor McDonald's sentence was, I think, 2 years before.
And he never served a day.
Never served a day. He got an appeal bond. The system doesn't make a lot of sense.
Was he offered a plea deal? Was Rod Blagojevich offered a plea deal?
Well, I was not his trial attorney, so you'd have to ask his trial attorneys about that. I don't know. I know he wouldn't have taken it because in his heart, he didn't do anything wrong. He was following the rules as he understood them about fundraising. And as, you know, Patty sort of explained to you, I mean, the rules on fundraising, federal judges have looked at them and say, these are murky. I don't understand them. It used to be the rule that if you ask somebody for a contribution, even though you know they want something in return from you, you're safe as long as you don't make any promise to them. Blagojevich followed that rule, and they put him in prison anyway.
From a legal perspective, what do you do next? You've been rejected by the Supreme Court to be heard twice. We've talked about what Patty is doing, and we'll continue conversation with Patty. But legally, what are the things that can be done now?
Well, Patty's absolutely correct in what she said. Really, the only legal avenue he would have is if there's a change in the law, and that is if the Supreme Court finally decides to take a look at the circuit split, which right now, if you're out on the East Coast an elected official, there's one set of rules. It's much harder to get a conviction. But if you're here in the Midwest at a city like Chicago, it's very easy for prosecutors to get a conviction. That has to be reconciled by the Supreme Court someday. They decided not to do it with Rod Blagojevich's case, but maybe they'll take another case. The problem is, as Patty also said, very few elected officials are prosecuted for fundraising violations. Blagojevich is one of the few. And the reason why he was targeted for fundraising is because the centerpiece of the case, as you remember, the thing that Pat Fitzgerald said was had Lincoln rolling over in his grave, was that he tried to make a deal with Barack Obama over the Senate seat, basically to trade political appointments. He was going to appoint Obama's choice, Valerie Jarrett, for the Senate, and in exchange, he wanted to be Health and Human Services Secretary. And Blagojevich's point was, in his mind, I would be the best person for this job. I gave health care to so many kids here in Illinois. I would be a great Health and Human Services Secretary. He truly believed that. He tried to make a political deal, and I think that was the centerpiece of the case. That's what Pat Fitzgerald said. We had to stop this crime spree before it happened.
We've got a pause. Okay. I'm Bruce Dumont. Thanks for joining us tonight. Are you planning for the day when you can retire to your dream home in Palm Springs, California? A day surrounded by spectacular scenery, golf courses, a rich cultural life, and great dining? If you are, you'll need a guide, someone who knows where to look, an experienced broker, someone who knows the desert communities of Southern California and all they have to offer. That person is Brian Beard, who's been making dreams come true for over 13 years, selling over $100 million in real estate, including celebrity and architecturally significant homes to the rich and famous, and more importantly, to people just like you. Brian's company, Coldwell Banker, has agents worldwide, but Brian Beard is your man in Palm Springs. Call Brian now at 760-799-7096. That's 760-799-7096. Or visit him online at BrianSellsTheDesert.com. Bruce Dumont back. Thanks very much for joining us tonight. We're talking with Patty Blagojevich. She is the former First Lady of Illinois, and we're talking about her attempts to get early release for her husband, who's serving a 14-year sentence in Colorado, by the way, in federal prison for political corruption. A recent article in Chicago Magazine detailed the trials and tribulations that he has on a daily basis, and I'd like to spend a little time talking about the trials and tribulations that you spend every day thinking about your husband in federal prison, because so many people, I think, do not understand that any sentence, whether it be for a state crime or a federal crime, those that are affected by it are family. In many cases, not as much as the person who's been incarcerated, but a very short second place.
Oh, it's definitely a very short second place. I mean, the people that I think are the biggest victims in all of this are my daughters, for sure. I mean, Rod decided to go into politics. Knowing what we know now, I would never advise anybody to go into politics. You're putting your family at risk that you could become a victim of an overzealous prosecutor. But my girls didn't ask for this. They are unfortunately blessed with a very recognizable last name, and this is a burden that they've now had to carry with them going into high school, into college, throughout their lives. And it's, even for them, what's the hardest part is the tremendous anxiety that they feel when they have to say their name out loud, because they just never know what kind of reaction they're going to get from people. And usually when we meet people and they recognize the name or recognize us, it's overwhelmingly positive, but it's just, you never know. That's that uneasiness. So it's the hardest for my girls, it's for sure. And I know you asked me if the girls wanted to come on the show today. Mm-hmm. And I asked them, and they would have done it if I pressed them. But the problem is that they've put themselves out before to try to help their dad at the last sentencing hearing. They both went up before the judge and spoke very movingly about their father and why they needed him home. And they were immediately, their comments were immediately disregarded by the judge, and he's, reinstated that 14-year sentence again. And it's just like a wound that will never heal for them. And so now we're like a little bit, almost a week past the bad news that we just recently got. And this last week, Annie missed 3 days of school. Amy's been home. She's at Northwestern. She's been home 3 nights where normally she lives on campus. The shock and the disappointment for them is so real and so devastating that they need to have it heal a little bit, and to keep talking about it is just like kind of picking that wound open again. So I couldn't have them come here just because we're finally starting to get back into, you know, on a normal footing where everybody can function and go to school. And for me, this is going to be my crusade to get their father home and get my husband home. This is not a burden that they need to be able to have to carry. It's not their job.
Rod, in this story, talked about his loneliness. Tell us about your emptiness, the emptiness of your life.
Oh, yeah.
For the last 6 years and from now until 2024, unless the president steps up.
Yeah, and that's just a scary, scary thing to think about. It's really, you know, Amy's a senior in college, so 4 of the last 6 years she's been at college. So, and I've tried to hold on to our family home as much as possible, but most of the time it's just my younger daughter Annie and I kicking around our house. And it's not only the, like, physical loneliness with just the two of us in the house, and, you know, he had his study in the house, you know, where his desk is and where his, you know, where all his books are, and his quite possibly the most beautiful room in our house, the library. But my girls I'd say, why don't you go in there and do your homework in there? You know, you could put on the fireplace, that kind of thing. And they don't even want to enter that room because it just reminds them that he's not home. And it's...
Does he want to ever see family pictures? I mean, you know, things in the past that, or will they just depress him?
Yeah, it's interesting because I know a lot of people and a lot of friends of his have written to him, and even friends of mine have written to him, and he doesn't even, you know, he'll read letters of people, like strangers that send him letters, but he doesn't like to read the letters from people he knows because that makes him sad that he's missing things. Like if, like, my friends would write about the girls or something that happened, it's just too heartbreaking for him to be face-to-face with what he's missing.
When you're a hot politician, and your husband was a hot politician, being reelected governor of Illinois, you're very popular. Everybody wants to gravitate to you. Everybody wants to go out to dinner with you. Those people that were close to you personally during the time when Rod was on top, how many of those people are still friends today?
Well, not a whole lot. You know, they say there's something. I had like a new definition of friendship after all this happened. And my definition of friendship is someone that will call you on the phone and ask you how you're doing, even if they think your phone might be bugged. Right? Because once, you know, there was any kind of, you know, once the arrest happened, that phone got really quiet. Nobody's calling. Nobody, it's like you've got smallpox or something like that. Nobody wants to catch what you've got. But, you know, ironically, it was my friends from college, those people I knew long before we were ever involved in politics, that wouldn't care. They're going to call up and ask me, how are you? What can we do for you? How can we help? Those are your true friends that, you know, they don't care who's listening. They're your friend, and they're going to be there to help you.
When did you first realize that your life was going to be changed?
I knew that when they came and arrested him. From that point on, I knew that things were never going to be the same again. It was just, there was no going back from that action of them arresting him.
What was that day like?
That day was like almost like a nightmare. It was a nightmare. You know, they came and the phone rang at 6:30 in the morning and somebody said, you know, this is the FBI. Come open the door. We're here to arrest your husband. And I immediately thought it was a prank caller and I hung up. I'm like, get lost. And then they called back and they said, no, you know, you better get down here. Otherwise we're going to break your door down. And so that was, It was terrifying. And, you know, I opened the door and they rushed into my house and ran up to the second floor into our bedroom, where my younger daughter, who was five, had, like, crawling into our bed with us in the middle of the night, like five-year-olds do sometimes. So she was asleep in our bed, and the FBI is on my second floor of my house, and my older daughter hears some noise, and she calls out, "Mommy," and I said to her, "Go back to sleep, honey. It's not time to get up yet," and I closed her door, and, you know, then they, you know, took them away while my girls were sleeping, and took them out our back and actually put handcuffs on them, and I looked at them and said, like, is this really necessary? You have to take them away in handcuffs under darkness? I mean, all they had to do was call up my husband's attorney and say, have your client come down to the, you know, office. I mean, there was no reason to come to our house and take them out of our house like that. And then the FBI agent had the nerve to say to me, "Well, we need to get going because the press isn't here yet." And I said to her, "The only reason the press would be here is if you called and told them. So what are you telling me? We have to get going because you know, obviously notified the press." It was, and then I had the only thought I had in my mind was I had to get my girls out of the house before the press showed up and get them off to school so I could figure out what in the world was going on, because it was so shocking. At the same time, I got a phone call from my sister-in-law saying the FBI had gone to my brother-in-law to open our campaign office. They'd knocked on their door at 6:30 in the morning. And at the same time, they went after my husband's chief of staff and some supporters, other supporters of my husband. They all, like, it was like a concerted effort to get everybody at 6:30 in the morning. And just get everybody at once. And so it was, I had to get my daughters off to school to try to figure out what, they couldn't even tell me, Bruce, what it was about. We had no idea why. It was something to do with the Senate seat. You know, that they didn't even have an indictment on my husband until like 4 months after he was arrested. They arrested him in December. The indictment didn't come, 5 months, did not come down until April. They didn't have any, they couldn't even tell us what it was all about.
The most famous, at least political acquaintance of your husband at that time, was Barack Obama.
Right.
During this entire ordeal, what did Barack Obama do, say, any communication at all?
Oh, no, nothing. He's one of the smallpox people, right? Like, he wasn't going to reach out to us, and, you know, there would never be anything that he would be able to, you know, do to help or reach out. There's not a single word.
Were there attempts to get his assistance?
No, the only thing that we did with regards to Barack Obama was towards the end of his sentence, we, you know, my daughters wrote him personal letters to try to ask him to commute my husband's sentence. I mean, he knows Rod, and, you know, they served together in the state legislature. He was a state senator when Rod was governor. You know, we had hoped that he would see fit to, you know, commute my husband's sentence at that time. And I know that people we know promised us they would put my daughter's letters into his hands. And so he did get a personal appeal from my girls and turned a deaf ear.
Rahm Emanuel, did he have any role?
No, Rahm's been, you know, supportive, I think in spirit, but, you know, certainly, you know, I think he's got his hands full as governor, as mayor.
So, again, within the political community, there wasn't anybody that stepped up that was going to be willing to make a call or at least give Rod a listen, or his case a listen.
No, you know, it's interesting.
Not that there was an attempt for obstruction of justice. I'm not suggesting that at all.
I know.
I'm just saying is that, you know, when sometimes, you know, a politician loses their power, they lose that power real fast.
You know, it's interesting because I think my husband's...
We're going to have to pause. Okay. I want to follow up on that when we continue. We're talking with Patty Blagojevich. I'm Bruce Dumont. Thanks for joining us tonight. Live from Chicago, it's Saturday Night Live, The Experience. Tuesday through Sundays and open late on Wednesday nights at the Museum of Broadcast Communications. Order tickets at museum.tv. Rooster Montbeck and Patty Bagoy, but you wanted to pick up on a point that we had to break for the spot for.
Sure. You were asking about why weren't there people, powerful people out there to help Rod after he got arrested. And I think it's because his entire career as governor, even before that, he was so focused on trying to help everyday people, to try to help the mom, single mom whose kid needs health care, and try to help the little old lady with her bus ride and trying to do, these capital bills to get people going back to work. He was so focused, and he was doing battle in Springfield, battling Mike Madigan, all the time, trying to move the state forward for like ordinary everyday people who were powerless. And so those powerless people couldn't do anything to help him. He didn't make his career garnering rich and fancy friends who were powerful and, hobnobbing with all the other governors. He never even would go to those governors' association meetings.
Yeah, he was independent.
Yeah.
Question, how often do you talk to Rod?
Every night. Every night he gets 300 minutes of phone time a month. So that's about 10 minutes.
Did he know you were doing this program this evening?
He did.
Any advice to you?
he says that he, gets good reports about, about me. So he feels pretty good.
How often do you visit?
Now it's about four times a year, and it gets less and less. I mean, when he was first out there, the first year or two, we were going a lot, and the kids were younger. They were both in high school. They were high school and grammar school. So as they get older and their lives become more complicated, and it's harder to pull them out of school without them getting behind, it gets to be less. And the really saddest part about this to me is that no one really wants to go visit him, and they don't want to go visit him because it's so sad. When you go to see him, and you even if it's like the weekend, and you see him a couple times, and then invariably when we'd leave on Sunday, Annie would cry all the way to the airport, in the plane on the way home, and then everyone, for at least a couple of weeks after that visit, there's a very palpable post-visit depression because, it's easy for the kids to, keep them busy. And that's what I've really done the last 6 years is keep them busy, keep them focused on school. Life goes on. But when they come face to face with their father that they're deprived of, it's so devastating to have to leave. And so, we're going back next month. And I, both kids were like kind of groaning. I'm like, don't you want to see your father? And Annie said to me, Mommy, I don't want to go because when I'm there, I'm so sad. When I'm there and when I'm home, I'm so depressed about it. And so, we know that it's important for them to see their father and, for them to talk to him all the time and to have that relationship going. But the toll is, this is lifelong. These are lifelong scars my girls have to live with.
And you.
Yeah, well, I mean,
when you go to that federal prison and you have to go through the metal detectors and take everything out of your pockets and walk in and wait until his number is called so he can come down and meet with you, there's an anticipation.
Right.
What goes through your mind when you see him walk through that door?
Well, I'm usually happy to see him, and I usually remark about, man, does he look skinny because, the prison food is terrible and so that's usually my first thought. But it was I'm really good about trying to keep that stiff upper lip for my girls. And the only exception to that was the very first time that we went to see him. Because I remember that it was, just the other day, 6 years ago, and we, fly into the Denver airport, and, it's all new. We'd never been there before, and you rent our car and get there, and we're driving, with our little GPS up to the prison. I could see it, and it's like Friday night and the sun's going down, and at that point it's like the tears were streaming down my face. I just couldn't believe that this is exactly, this was my life. I was like bringing my children to see their father in a federal penitentiary. And then at that time he was in the low security prison where it was all metal detectors and big doors clanking behind you, and like you said, sitting there waiting for him to come down, and I was crying, and Amy just said to me, Mommy, stop crying. Daddy doesn't want to see you do that. And that was pretty much my only, I feel like my only real moment that I couldn't hold it together for my girls.
The release date is May of 2024. Now, does that include the good time behavior? Is that
I think,
or is there
so
a date
I
less
think,
than that?
I think so, because 2024 would be 12 years, and the sentence was 14 years. So that includes the good behavior time.
Okay.
Which he's been exemplary. His behavior. So there's no reason to believe that that wouldn't.
One other question. It's a contemporary political question. But in the race for the governorship of Illinois, campaign spots are being used by the Republican incumbent that have a conversation, recorded conversation, FBI wiretap alleged, between your husband and J.B. Pritzker, the Democratic governor. You've seen those spots. They're all over the place. What's your reaction when you hear those spots?
Well, it's awful because it's awful for, first of all, it's incredibly infuriating that conversations that we wanted played in court to help exonerate my husband are now being used just for political reasons and are somehow out there. You know, that we have hours and hours of wiretaps that we wanted played in court, and we felt that if they were played to the jury, we wouldn't be sitting here today. But now that you know, they're being used for political purposes and we couldn't use them to help exonerate my husband is extremely upsetting. And on a personal note, my daughters watch TV too, and so my older daughter is sitting at, you know, Northwestern with her friends, and on comes these commercials. It's incredibly embarrassing and humiliating for my daughters to have to be sitting around with their friends and see commercials like this come on TV. It's so insensitive.
Last question. You grew up like everybody else, thinking truth, justice, and the American way. You've had your experience with the Federal Justice Department. What's your reaction now?
Yeah, I am. You know what? I have. It's not until you're through this situation. God, hopefully nobody listening will ever have to live through this. But you see things in a totally different light now. And, you know, now it's like I'm not one of those people that say, oh, they must be guilty just because they're charged, because I know the way this system works. And now I'm like almost lean the other way. I don't believe anybody's guilty anymore.
Patty Blagojevich, thanks very much for joining us. Leonard Goodman, thank you very much for being with
thanks
us as well. It's up to the President of the United States. We hope you enjoyed this interview. Whether you want to do anything to follow up on it, I guess a letter to the President is about the only thing you can do. I'm Bruce Dumont, back with another full hour. Thanks for joining us tonight.
When is the best time to talk to your family about staying in touch during a disaster? When floodwaters reach your door? When wildfires are engulfing the edge of your neighborhood? Or an earthquake is destroying buildings? Or is the best time, perhaps, today? During a disaster, you may not be able to stay in touch with your family or friends as easily as you think. Go to ready.gov/communicate and make your emergency plan today. Don't wait. Communicate. Brought to you by FEMA and the Ad Council.
Live from Chicago, it's Saturday Night Live, The Experience. Tuesday through Sundays and open late on Wednesday nights at the Museum of Broadcast Communications. Order tickets at museum.tv. Are you planning for the day when you can retire to your dream home in Palm Springs, California? A day surrounded by spectacular scenery, golf courses, a rich cultural life, and great dining? If you are, you'll need a guide, someone who knows where to look, an experienced broker, someone who knows the desert communities of Southern California and all they have to offer. That person is Brian Beard, who's been making dreams come true for over 13 years, selling over $100 million in real estate, including celebrity and architecturally significant homes to the rich and famous, and more importantly, to people just like you. Brian's company, Coldwell Banker, has agents worldwide, but Brian Beard is your man in Palm Springs. Call Brian now at 760-799-7096. That's 760-799-7096. Or visit him online at BrianSellsTheDesert.com. Live from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, professors, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from Coast to Coast. Tonight featuring commentary by Dave Lundy and Nick Kalm. Our program tonight coming to you from our home base at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago, where our toll-free lines are open at 1-800-723-8289. If you'd like to email me a comment, it's Bruce Dumont at museum.tv. If you want to send me an email, it's or tweet, it's Dumo at D-U-M-O. And of course, you can join us on the World Wide Web at beyondthebeltway.com. Well, in this segment, we're going to be talking about the past legal actions of what happened this past week in politics, primarily in Washington, D.C., obviously. But again, we've got a couple of our regular guests here who join us tonight, and I want to get there to spend a couple of minutes talking about their reaction to the interview with Patty Blagojevich, the former First Lady of Illinois, who's seeking public support for her appeal to the President of the United States to commute or pardon her husband, who's now serving 14 years in federal prison. Dave Lundy, you're the card-carrying Democrat. Your reaction to the interview and any new wrinkles that you heard tonight?
You know, I feel sorry for Patty's girls. I feel very sorry for Patty's girls. It's a horrible thing. I think that the sentence was too long. I think that's something that we all agree on. I think even Nick agrees that that was a pretty extensive and excessive sentence. I'm surprised it didn't get reduced previously. But the idea that Rod Blagojevich was an innocent victim who just happened to be the target of overzealous federal prosecutors is not consistent with history. And I am, look, Pat Quinn was governor of the state of Illinois. No prosecutions. I'm not even sure there was an investigation over those several years. Bruce Rauner is a horrendously bad governor, but nobody accuses him of being corrupt, and there are no investigations to the best of my knowledge. You don't just wind up in jail because you've got prosecutors that are looking for somebody to throw in jail.
But would you acknowledge that you could end up with 14 years because during pretrial you decided you were going to make the government a target and you were going to go on any media outlet that, you know, more than 10,000 watts to make them look bad?
Look, it is not a surprise that government prosecutors and judges –
yes.
Don't take kindly to being called names and being told they're bad people and being told that it's a witch hunt. Wrong guy. You just don't do that. You are expected, when you go before a judge, you're expected to show some measure of contrition. And when you don't, they throw the book at you.
Nick Kalm is our card-carrying Republican. Your area of expertise is reputations and repairing reputations. I want to talk a little bit about that as it relates to Rod Blagojevich at the moment, but your reaction to anything in the interview or the fact that he was sentenced to 14 years in prison?
Well, I think the world is probably coming to an end because I agree with every word that Dave Lundy said in his opening comments. I mean, he and I are both spin doctors by profession, and that was too much spin even for us. It was, you know, it's really unfortunate. There certainly, she was still being consistent with what she said, during the trial and after the trial. And I think, yeah, the sentence was too long, but I mean, there's no question about it that, he got what he deserved because he brought it on himself.
Why would President Trump commute or pardon Rod Blagojevich?
Well,
give me the reasons why he would do it. And then we're going to let Dave give the reasons why he wouldn't do it.
Well, I think he would do it if he wanted to send the signal again about overzealous prosecutors. But that,
like Scooter Libby?
Like Scooter Libby. But now that he's pardoned Scooter Libby, the need or the opportunity to pardon Rod Blagojevich has diminished, if not disappeared entirely.
Dave Lundy.
You know, I think the only reason to do it is to send a message to James Comey, who was Rob Mueller,
yeah,
who was at the time the head of the FBI, was, you know, the FBI was intimately involved in that prosecution and the multi-year investigations.
And the wiretaps.
You know, I'm reminded of the fact there were several things that were expected to happen, and indictments that were expected to be brought, that never were. Remember, there was a whole series of scandals around board appointments. In fact, his father-in-law, Patty's dad, Dick Mell,
right,
you know, talked about how, Rod was selling board seats. And that was never brought because the Senate seat issue took precedence. Mm-hmm. But so the reason I could imagine the President Trump potentially doing something, possibly commuting the sentence, is just another way of saying to the prosecutors, I'm on top here. I think it's different with Scooter Libby. I think that was much more about sending a message to some of the potential witnesses in the Mueller probe. This would be more kind of a, hey, I can do this, and you're just the prosecutor.
There is also one other perhaps rationale. And the president has certainly found ways to address this issue. And that is, it changes the subject. I mean, if the president wants to change the subject and he's got a bad news day, this would dominate the news for a news cycle or two.
Yes, absolutely. But again, it's not that interesting. It's interesting to Patty and the girls. And again, I would have no problem if he wanted to commute that sentence, because I think the sentence was too long. I think a pardon would be out of line, but a commutation right. would be okay. But I just don't see this as a huge national interest.
Does a computation? Well, the reason about Rod Blagojevich made himself a national interest during this period, and I'm just suggesting that there also the issue that a computation maybe sends some degree of goodwill to others, because I made the point. I mean, there's tens of thousands of people who feel that their husbands have been either wrongly convicted or have been given too many sentences. So does this give hope to them, or does it run the other way?
The thing is, President Trump, if he wants to send that sort of a signal to people who are wrongly tried, wrongly convicted, wrongly imprisoned, he has a whole heck of a lot more sympathetic people to choose from in that regard.
Right. And also, generally speaking, controversial pardons or computations come towards the end of a presidential term, and that's a long way away.
Well, I know it'll be no shock to you, Bruce, but President Trump does seem to be turning presidential tradition on its ear.
Yes, I know. That's what I'm saying. That's what I'm saying. He could do it if he's got a slow day. And
although he does have lots of other things that he can, a lot of other arrows in that quiver, too.
Yeah. Speaking of that, let's switch gear to the bigger, broader issues of the legal issues and that surround the president. What was the most significant legal thing that happened last week to the president, in your view, Nick?
The most significant legal thing that's happened for the president in the last week? Well, I don't know if it was quasi-legal, but it's basically, I would say, it's the James Comey book tour. That is probably the most significant, because clearly Comey had been set up by himself and by the Democrats and by the media as being the main antagonist, who's at least going on record about what's going on. And unfortunately for Comey, he largely destroyed his own credibility with his media appearances.
And Dave, I know you may have a different view of that, but when we come back, we're going to also open up phone lines. 1-800-723-8029 from coast to coast and border to border. How do you feel how the president handled himself last week? And also about the book tour and James Comey. Has his reputation been completely destroyed, or do you still put him on a pillar? Back shortly from Chicago. First of all, back in Chicago, Dave Lundy, what do you think of the James Comey media rollout right now?
Well, I'm sure this is going to come as a shock, but I don't agree with Nick's characterization, that Comey completely destroyed his credibility. Look,
not completely. Did he destroy it somewhat?
Well, the thing is, he had started to hurt his credibility. I would agree with that. But he was rescued by the Republican House members of the Intelligence Committee, who threatened to impeach Rod Rosenstein if he didn't release Comey's memos. So Comey wrote these 15 different memos, and he wrote them contemporaneously with his interactions with President Trump, because he felt like President Trump was untrustworthy. And so the memos were other than two of them, the memos were not leaked to anybody. They were just written and held within the FBI. And so Rod Rosenstein declined to offer them up to the House Republicans who wanted to see them And they got into a little bit of a pissing contest. And at the end of the day, they forced the release of the memos. The memos were given to Congress. And within about 15 minutes, they were publicly available in the press. But the memos back up everything James Comey said. The memos back up his recollection. The memos back up his testimony to Congress. The memos back up the stories that were written early on. There is nothing that is inconsistent between the memos and what Comey
said. Where is the smoking gun, Dave? Where is their smoking gun? Where is Comey's smoking gun about Trump's supposed obstruction of justice or anything else like that? I hope you go easy on Mike Flynn. That's the smoking gun. I hope you can let this go or whatever he said that was basically. And again, even if you decide that was obstruction of justice, which it clearly wasn't, it's basically him not believing that Flynn was guilty of anything.
Okay, well, A, that's only a small, small part of the obstruction of justice question. Part of the obstruction of justice question was him firing Comey because he wanted to get him stop the Russia investigation. That's what he told the Russians in the Oval Office the day after he fired Comey. So I love the Republican talking point now that, well, there was no obstruction because it wasn't in the memos. Well, of course it wasn't in the memos. That happened after.
Here's the question that I have, and I wrote a Facebook post on it, and I want to get your reaction face to face because you're both Facebook friends of mine. When I watched the interview last week, the one thing that stuck out very early in the interview was when Comey said that he went in and he explained to Donald Trump some of the salacious aspects of the dossier. And I think George Stephanopoulos asked the question, well, you mean the Steele, did you reference the Steele dossier? And Comey says, no, I don't think I mentioned that name. And then Stephanopoulos asks, did you let him know the origin of that essay or the dossier? And Comey said, no, I just didn't think it was important to my goal for the meeting. Now, the next question was, which wasn't asked, what was your goal for the meeting? I mean, here you are, the top law enforcement officer in the United States. You're meeting the president-elect of the United States. You're making a decision that you're going to share with him salacious information about him. And you don't report the origins and the fingerprints that are on that? I find that incredible. And I also find it incredible that Donald Trump didn't ask him what is your source. I'm shocked by each of those actions.
Well, look, Trump is new to all of this, though, Bruce. That's the whole thing. I mean, this is a whole new world for him.
But
that
if
he
somebody
stepped into,
is spreading really garbage information about you now, wouldn't you want to say, well, where's
who
this
said
coming
that?
From?
No, but
I'm questioning both people here.
The better question is why Comey didn't reveal it, and
yes.
he signaled why he didn't because he had all of these knots in his stomach. I mean, he was like, I mean, what are you? The head of the FBI, or are you like a little girl or something? It's like he was so worked up about so-called his role in helping elect Donald Trump that I think he was trying to make up for it by basically presenting this information in a way that wouldn't help Trump at all.
I think that's a total misread. First of all, I agree with you. It's strange he didn't offer it up. I find it stranger that Trump didn't ask. I mean, look, if you and I were meeting and you said, Dave, I know this is out there. I've heard this. My first question would be, where did you hear it from?
Mm-hmm.
Because that's absurd. And so.
Well, I think the first thing to do would be to deny it and worry that your wife might know about it, which allegedly is what he said. The second, you're talking to the head of the FBI. He's supposed to know the answers to all of these questions.
Right.
And obviously he didn't ask the question, but again, if you're judging the integrity of the FBI director, he was not there to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
Well,
to the president.
But hang on a second, because just what would be the what would he be trying to gain by withholding, by intentionally withholding that information?
I don't know.
Because the
to make it appear more credible.
Yeah, but the point wasn't whether it was credible or not. The point was that it existed and that there were people out there who were threatening to use it against him. That was
the point of the conversation. I think the source was important because what you have there is you have an unwillingness of the FBI to provide a specific to the president-elect of the United States, just as the FBI and the Justice Department failed to provide specific information when they went to the FISA court. They didn't say that Hillary Clinton's fingerprints or her campaign's were fingerprints.
Oh, come
on. They didn't say it.
Oh, come on. They very clearly said this is from political opposition. And at the time, the political opposition was Hillary Clinton. And so it's either Hillary Clinton or it's the Democrats.
No, the political opposition.
What does it matter whether it's Hillary Clinton or
no,
the Democrats?
No, because I think a big question. Political opposition at that point in time could have been from a variety of sources. I mean, there could have been political opposition that started during the primaries.
I think the larger question is, and I think somebody should have asked this question. There are a lot of questions. We've watched these interviews. I think I've seen four of these interviews. And I'm always yelling at the television saying, ask this follow-up, and they never do. But the best follow-up in that case would be, would you have told the president where the information came from had he asked? Comey may have just assumed, well, I'm going to give you this, and then the president's going to ask questions and say, well, where did this come from? And I would have volunteered that information. I think you guys are trying to make a mountain out of a molehill in terms of that question
about
disclosure.
Speaking of mountains out of molehills, the Mueller investigation, all of this stuff, I mean, it's been now more than a year. The media, every Democratic activist group, Mueller's team have all been digging and digging and digging and digging. When does this come to an end? You had Patty Blagojevich on in your last segment. There's no question that prosecutors can be overzealous, and special prosecutors can be overzealous for sure, right?
Yes.
I mean, let's ask Ken Starr about that.
Although that's a totally different statute.
All right, I understand.
He had no, but this is really important because this was a point that one of Donald Trump's flacks tried to make today, this morning, is to say, well, this is just like Kenneth Starr.
Independent counsel versus special counsel. I understand the difference.
That's independent counsel had no, there was nobody looking over his shoulder.
The point I was making, which you've now tried to derail, Dave, is that the investigation has been going on about Donald Trump for more than a year, and with lots of different parties looking, and there's nothing there. When do they say there's nothing there? When do they acknowledge there's nothing there? Is it after?
Was it 4 or 5 years?
Is it after the midterms when the Democrats take back enough seats to begin nonstop impeachment hearings?
Okay, first
that's
of all,
the question.
To Bruce's point, Ken Starr was, I think, 4.5 years. Second of all, you sound just like Richard Nixon did a year into the Watergate investigation. At what point? When are we going to drop this? It's been going on for more than a year. I'm sorry, the time clock is not the relevant factor here. There have been 19 indictments. We know that they have evidence about the Russians. We know that they have evidence about the Russian interference in the election. We know that there's evidence of, hang on, we know that there are serious questions about members of the Trump team, including Michael Cohen, including the June visit with Kushner, with Manafort. Manafort, his campaign chair, got indicted. Two of his
for activities before he became Trump's campaign chairman.
You're right, but Manafort was a well-known Russian stooge.
Does this issue, the Russian investigation, it seems to me that you've got the anti-Trumpers on one side, you got the pro-Trumpers on the other side. Where are the independents? Where are the people who are somewhat apolitical, yet they will vote in November, and they could care less about this issue?
Yes, I would prefer that.
To them, it's all rearview mirror stuff. It has nothing to do with Donald Trump as the president. Let's get on. Let's talk about issues that are important to us. What percentage of people
is
they're going to decide what happens in November?
It's a small number. The independents are going to decide, partly based on what the media keeps telling them, which is that Trump is the devil incarnate. But part of it's going to be in terms of pocketbook issues. You know, we have the tariffs that got put in place and the Chinese caved. We're on the eve now, potentially, of North Korea agreeing to really give up their nukes, not the way they have for the last 30 years, potentially. If it is like everything's been the last 30 years, then it's going to be no different whatsoever. But the tax cut, and I know that's not popular, but people having more money in their pocket, that is what's going to cause them to vote one way or the other. If the economy improves, they're going to be more supportive. But the bigger issue is Trump isn't on the ballot in November. The personality that he brings, he has no coattails. I think everybody can agree to that. And Paul Ryan, stepping aside on his own terms, strongly suggests that the Republicans are going to lose the House.
Yeah, Trump is absolutely on the ballot, not physically, but he is absolutely.
Of course, he is
on
for every Democrat, absolutely.
Yeah, and every Republican, including the record number of Republican retirements from the House. Look, I think that I would be very happy, and because I've actually said this on this show repeatedly, that Let Mueller do his work. I don't want to spend all this time talking about Russia. I want to talk about everything else that Donald Trump has done to degrade the presidency and destroy our country. And I want to make the election in November about that.
Okay. Will that record include Secretary of State Mike Pompeo? We'll talk about that when we come back. 1-800-723-8289. The question, should the President of the United States be allowed his pick to be Secretary of State? Back shortly. Are you planning for the day when you can retire to your dream home in Palm Springs, California? A day surrounded by spectacular scenery, golf courses, a rich cultural life, and great dining? If you are, you'll need a guide, someone who knows where to look, an experienced broker, someone who knows the desert communities of Southern California and all they have to offer. That person is Brian Beard, who's been making dreams come true for over 13 years, selling over $100 million in real estate, including celebrity and architecturally significant homes to the rich and famous, and more importantly, to people just like you. Brian's company, Coldwell Banker, has agents worldwide, but Brian Beard is your man in Palm Springs. Call Brian now at 760-799-7096. That's 760-799-7096. Or visit him online at BrianSellsTheDesert.com. Rooster Mott Beck, let's go to Mike listening to us on KXLY in Spokane, Washington. Go ahead, Mike. You're on the air.
Thank you, Bruce, for taking my call. This is since the FBI raided Michael Cohen's home, President Trump's legal attorney, and endangering lawyer-client privilege, regardless of what we think of Trump. Has this been appealed at all, which sets a precedent? What is the status of this appeal?
Well, it's not appealed at the moment. The information has been gathered. There's now legal action going on as to how much of that gathered information from Michael Cohen. The Justice Department is in possession of it, and the Trump lawyers are saying, we want to see everything that you have, and that's where it is to my knowledge. And the question is whether or not there are things in there that violate lawyer-client privileges.
But the bar to be able to do that, to be able to pierce the attorney-client privilege veil, right, and look at these documents, that is supposedly extraordinarily high. And again, whether there's accuracy in Trump's tweets and statements about that, any reasonable person who has an attorney for any legitimate reason has to be concerned that what they've believed to be the case for years, that it is sacrosanct, a client's communication with his or her attorney is not ever going to be revealed, has to wonder whether that has flown out the window now.
But attorney-client privilege is not absolute.
Right.
Attorney-client privilege is limited. And so if they were doing deals as business partners, not as if Cohen was functioning, not as his lawyer, there's no privilege there. And so that is a question that undoubtedly is going to be.
But is he providing legal information? I mean, that would seem to be a fine hair to kind of split.
Well, and that's going to be
legal
he's
giving business advice.
Well, that's going to be a question for the courts to decide. I mean, look, as a recovering attorney,
there may be other things that Michael Cohen is involved in, aware of, that are part of what they will find or they will get clarified, and they will have information. You would think they'd have enough information to squeeze Michael Cohen, and according to the published reports, one of the things that the White House allegedly is concerned about is that they've got information, they're gonna twist them. They're gonna make them turn on the president and start singing like a songbird.
Well, and maybe that's one of the reasons why he pardoned Scooter Libby as well. Just to basically say, don't worry about it. Whatever they convict you of, just, you know, be strong, you know, don't turn anything over. Who knows?
But it's interesting
he's already turned it over.
Because it was seized.
Seized, yeah.
Right, but it's interesting because, look, the president has said over and over again and has tweeted, he's been the tweeter-in-chief this weekend, but he's tweeted a lot about how Michael Cohen is not going to turn on him. And, look, the person who's saying that Michael Cohen is going to turn on him is Donald Trump's divorce lawyer. And the other person who's saying that Michael Cohen's going to turn on him is Roger Stone. So it's not as if this is just a bunch of Democrats that are saying, oh, Michael Cohen's going to turn on you. I mean, they're saying he's going to turn on him in a heartbeat. Roger Stone was interviewed the other night and said that Michael Cohen was abused by Donald Trump for years and years and years, emotionally abused. Look, Roger Stone, he's been on this show. I was on the show with Roger Stone once. Was interesting.
Mike, thanks for your call. Let's go to Scott in Austin, Texas. Go ahead, you're on the air. Scott, are you there?
Sound like you dropped
off. Scott, line three, are you there? Well, he's not popping up here, so we're going to move on to the question I asked before the break. Every president in the history of the country has been able to put in place a Secretary of State that he wants to guide him and consult with him in the foreign affairs of the United States. Why should that tradition be broken? Because Democrats in the U.S. Senate don't like Mike Pompeo. Dave.
Well, Bruce, I think you might want to direct your attention to Rand Paul, who is a Republican.
He's
and
not
who,
here.
What's that?
He's not here. I'm directing them to you. You're going to pick out the one.
He's
Republican.
Ducking it again.
No, I'm not going to. I'm not.
I'm asking you a practical question here.
Yes, okay? There are serious questions about Mike Pompeo.
In the country, what are the serious reservations about Michael Pompeo, who was approved by this Democratic Senate to be the head of the CIA that's got a hell of a lot more secrets than the Secretary of State?
There's a big difference between being the chief diplomat of the United States and being the chief spook of the United States.
And what are
and
they?
I think that, what's that?
What are they?
They're different skill requirements to represent the United
Based
States.
Based on what job description by whom? Written
what,
by whom?
The founding fathers and what the Secretary of State is.
I don't think they wrote about qualifications.
No, they wrote
about... Are you talking about the ability of someone to speak quietly and maybe secretly go over to meet with Kim Jong-un without anybody in the Washington press corps knowing about it? Now, is that the spook? Or is that
which, by the way, is the reason that that was leaked out in order to help his support for Secretary of State.
Was it a good move for him to make?
Sure, yeah, absolutely.
Okay, now, was he acting as the spook, or was he acting as the Secretary of State in waiting when he did this?
It is not.
This is a very important endeavor. This is a very important time in the history of the country because 3 months ago, we were talking about the possibility of nuclear war with North Korea. The president and Kim Jong-un together, independently, these two wacky guys, they have reduced the level and the likelihood of that. They want to talk now. And some people have said, well, we shouldn't talk without having some preconditions. So the president approves Mike Pompeo going secretly to North Korea to meet with Kim Jong-un to set up this big meeting that could save and denuclearize the Korean Peninsula. This is big, big stuff. This is really big stuff. Why shouldn't the president be able to select the man or woman he wants to send to do this job? No other president has been denied this in the history of the country.
Okay. I'm not sure what your point is, Bruce. There's an advise and consent role of the United States Senate.
My point is they have already given advice and consent for Mike Pompeo
for a
to be,
different job.
Dave, come on. That's so disingenuous.
It's not disingenuous.
It is disingenuous.
Okay, then why was Merrick Garland approved almost unanimously for the appellate court and denied even a vote for the Supreme Court?
Apples and oranges.
And so is CIA Secretary of State.
Really? Tell me the difference. I know the roles are different, but tell me, who do you think knows more about what's going on in the world? Is it the Secretary of State?
One is a diplomatic job managing a massive enterprise. And by the way, one of the key questions that I think the Senate is entitled to ask is whether he is going to restore the State Department. I know that came up. No, you could shake your head all
Dave,
you want.
It's ridiculous.
It's not ridiculous.
Dave, let me say something.
Have a State Department
Dave,
that has massive vacancies.
That has absolutely nothing to do with anything at all, but a nice try to deflect it again. Let me make this one point, Dave. If it was a Republican-controlled Congress with one Democrat like your Rand Paul distraction who was preventing Barack Obama from naming Hillary Clinton or anybody else that he chose as his Secretary of State, you would appropriately be going absolutely bananas. There's no question about that. You can deny it if you like, but that's, it's absolutely false. Pompeo graduated from Yale, graduated from West Point, number one in his class, confirmed it for the CIA. This is all pure politics, but this is now the Democrats, and if you want to throw Rand Paul in, taking politics to a new level. To Bruce's point, it's never been done in more than 200 years of history in this country.
Okay,
but
so
the Democrats are doing it now on somebody who is eminently qualified.
I'm going to ask you a question now from a political standpoint. Is this a battle the president wants to win? Or by keeping Mike Pompeo from going to Secretary of State, does that give the Republicans an issue in every campaign for every U.S. Senate seat that's up in a red state to go and make the case like I've just made to Dave that the Democrat incumbent senator in that state is un-American?
Well, that certainly gives you a lot of campaign fodder to use. And if, God forbid, things go sideways now with North Korea because the president couldn't have his choice, who'd already developed a rapport with Kim Jong-un in place, absolutely.
Do you believe at one point it was suggested that Rudy Giuliani was going to be Secretary of State? Rudy Giuliani has now joined, this was early in the administration, Rudy Giuliani is now back in the public forefront, being a member of Trump's legal team. Does this set up a situation where, is if Michael Pompeo is discarded by the U.S. Senate, is Rudy Giuliani there to be his next choice, and do the Democrats do a number on him, and we have a vacant office of Secretary of State? Dave, who would you rather have? Let me ask you, who would you rather have as Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo or Rudy Giuliani, if those were your choices?
Is death an option?
No.
Look, first of all, I don't think Rudy Giuliani was ever considered for Secretary of State.
He was.
Giuliani was.
Early. Bizarre choice.
Yeah. Well,
Giuliani interests and the consultancy that he did for all these. You remember that, I'm sure.
I totally forgot the Giuliani boomlet.
Back to my question.
And back to my challenge.
By the way, you never asked me what I thought about this. You just.
What do you want? Well, I asked you. For it.
No, you asked me if it's legitimate
vote?
For the Democrats to do this, and it's absolutely legitimate.
Oh, it's
I don't have a vote. I think that Mike Pompeo is an extremist with extreme views. I think that
What are the extremist views that he has?
Oh, Bruce, Mike Pompeo was an extreme conservative, which is one of the reasons that he was put in place in the CIA. I had no problem with him taking the CIA job.
Why?
I think it's a different position to be Secretary of State. And I don't understand why you're suggesting that there's no difference in the skills or in the positions or in the roles being Secretary of State and being the head of the CIA.
The Senate just confirmed him to be the head of the CIA. What was that? Not even a year ago.
Great! So he should stay as head of the CIA.
I want to get
and
everybody's reaction.
The president shouldn't have his
this.
Choice. Yes.
Does the president deserve the right to select his Secretary of State?
Dave
and
says
how
no.
How should we view Democrats who say no to tradition? Back shortly. Live from Chicago, it's Saturday Night Live, The Experience. Tuesday through Sundays. And open late on Wednesday nights at the Museum of Broadcast Communications. Order tickets at museum.tv. We are back, and John, listening to us on KBOI in Boise, Idaho, has called to my attention that it is Pompeo. Not Pompeo.
No, it is Pompeo, not Pompeo.
Well, then I am right and John is wrong.
Pompeo.
I thought it was Pompeo.
I know,
so anyway,
you said Pompeo.
Well, you say Pompeo, I say Pompeo. Let's go to Jim in Sacramento, California. Let's cut the whole deal off. Go ahead. You're listening to KTKZ, the Sacramento of the Golden State, the capital of the Golden State. Go ahead.
Yes. I think he should be confirmed. Just 3 months ago, we were on the verge of Armageddon, and it was on the news on every single second of the day how Trump was being bombast and being so authoritative, he was going to give us in, and so forceful that he was going to give it, get us in a potential nuclear war. Everybody was going nuts. And now, we know that Pompeo has gone behind the scenes, back channel, and started negotiations, and North Korea is willing to come to the table for the first time and get something worked out with the United States and North Korea. I think that should be noted. And it's never, and I'm an independent, and the Democrats will never give this president one sentence of positive affirmation, no matter what he does or how he does it. They refuse to be positive in any way, shape, or form.
Jim, as you were speaking and citing your litany of all the good things that Pompeo has done, Dave Lundy, you could not hear him on the radio. He was shaking his head horizontally, disagreeing with you. So, Dave, where is Jim wrong?
He's wrong that we've never sat down with North Korea. Of course we've sat down with North Korea.
Madeleine Albright.
We have repeatedly sat down with North Korea. And I'm going to quote Ari Fleischer, the noted conservative and George W. Bush's press secretary.
Yes.
He tweeted out yesterday, "Call me a cynic, but based on history, number one, they'll suspend today and begin again tomorrow. Number two, they have alternative ways, sites to carry out their mission. And number three, they're lying now or will lie tomorrow. This is how North Korea behaves. Remember the agreed framework." My simple point is, this is Ari Fleischer. You attack Ari, don't attack me. My simple point, though, is we don't know that we have anything agreed to whatsoever.
No, but that's everything that Ari Fleischer, that you read, that Ari Fleischer said is correct. But so is the caller in terms of, and what Bruce was saying earlier, we were allegedly on the brink of nuclear war 3 months ago. Do you remember that, Dave?
Yes, I do.
Okay. Are we now in a slightly different political posture relative to North Korea?
It would appear so.
Appear so? Maybe just slightly different, Dave?
It would appear
just slightly different. That there is got to be some acknowledgement of that.
I will acknowledge that we are not in the same position we were when he was calling him Little Rocket Man.
Is that a good thing?
Go
ahead, Jim.
But here's the case. He is a dictator. What dictator is going to come to the table and be honest and be forthright and be willing to do exactly what the agreement says? None of them do. We give them something quid pro quo. You give us something, we give you something, and you try to get the best deal you possibly can when you know full well that they're not going to hold up to the entire agreement. We all know this. Secondly, real quick, I want to talk quickly about the James Comey when he went into the office. James Comey should have been forthright in telling the president why exactly he was there. This is what I have, Mr. President. This is what's going on. And this is what I'm giving you the information, the proper information you need to make a rational decision. There should have been no ambiguity whatsoever coming from the head of the FBI talking to his boss, the president of the United States. Secondly, I'm a federal employee. I work for the Social Security Administration. I took an oath to uphold the Constitution, as did any other congressman, person that works for the United States government. And I hold that oath dear to my heart. We have real problems in this country, and we are sick and tired. We the people are sick and tired of these nuanced questions. And you guys came up with four or five questions: why Jim Comey did this, and how he did that, how Trump should have said this, and why didn't he say that? Instead of just being straight ahead and saying Comey should have told me exactly what was going on.
Yeah, that's my point.
Sealed document. It's ridiculous, and the American people are sick and tired of it, and you're going to see that reflected in the voting come 2018 and in the presidential election in the next presidency.
Jim, thank you for your call from Sacramento. Let's head to San Francisco, not too far away. Michael is listening to us on Sirius XM Satellite Radio. You take the other position on Mr. Pompeo. Why?
Well, Trump had his choice, and he blew it once, and as a matter of fact, he's blown pretty much all of his choices.
No. What are you talking about, sir?
He picked a Secretary of State.
Yes, and the Secretary of State did not work out to the president's liking, and the president has an opportunity to let people go if he doesn't think they're doing a good job.
Which means that the Congress and the Democrats, and by the way, the Republicans, last time anyone looked, are in the majority.
Yes.
But and that means that this time we're going to be a little more careful. We're not going to just let this mindless, half-witted president just pick any old person he wants and cause a lot of trouble. and then have to go through this all over again.
Michael, one second. Here's my point. You can disagree, but when you're talking about a half-witted president, we know who you're talking about. When you're talking about Michael Pompeo, you're talking about a guy who was number one at West Point, a graduate from Harvard Law School, a longtime member of Congress, who was confirmed by the Senate in many Democratic votes to be the head of the CIA, the number one spook in the world. So the guy is not exactly chopped liver.
Take the CIA out of it, you throw a rock in Washington, you'll hit 10 people who aren't Muslim haters and gay haters like Mike Pompeo, who have equally, if not better, qualifications and aren't going to bend over and do exactly what Trump does. And by the way, the idea that we are on the brink of nuclear war with North Korea is so silly that it's hard to even stop laughing thinking about that idea.
Okay. Laugh your troubles away, Michael. We thank you for your call. We do appreciate it to hear the perspective from San Francisco this evening. And again, we thank you very much. Our thanks to Nick Comm and our thanks to Dave Lundy for being with us this evening. Early in the broadcast, we heard from Larry Goodman, and our special guest earlier was Patty Blagojevich, the former First Lady of Illinois. Thank you all for joining us. I'm Bruce Dumont. Good night from Chicago.
When is the best time to talk to your family about staying in touch during a disaster? When floodwaters reach your door? When wildfires are engulfing the edge of your neighborhood? Or an earthquake is destroying buildings? Or is the best time, perhaps, today? During a disaster, you may not be able to stay in touch with your family or friends as easily as you think. Go to ready.gov/communicate and make your emergency plan today. Don't wait. Communicate. Brought to you by FEMA and the Ad Council.
Live from Chicago, it's Saturday Night Live, The Experience. Tuesday through Sundays and open late on Wednesday nights at the Museum of Broadcast Communications. Order tickets at museum.tv. Are you planning for the day when you can retire to your dream home in Palm Springs, California? A day surrounded by spectacular scenery, golf courses, a rich cultural life, and great dining? If you are, you'll need a guide, someone who knows where to look, an experienced broker, someone who knows the desert communities of Southern California and all they have to offer. That person is Brian Beard, who's been making dreams come true for over 13 years, selling over $100 million in real estate, including celebrity and architecturally significant homes to the rich and famous, and more importantly, to people just like you. Brian's company, Coldwell Banker, has agents worldwide, but Brian Beard is your man in Palm Springs. Call Brian now at 760-799-7096. That's 760-799-7096. Or visit him online at briansellsthedesert.com.